It's been almost a month since the school shooting in Parkland, Florida, that inspired what looks like a new chapter in youth activism. Back then, everyone was talking about it, including maybe especially teenagers. So is it still a big deal to them?
It's a really big deal to me.
That's Malia Biswell at Oak Park High School, where students have planned a walkout for today.
And there is the general feeling of we want change. So I think that the Parkland shooting brought on a movement and something that could be big, such as the civil rights movement, something huge that could really make a big change that our generation is starting and that our generation is demanding.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and on this National Day of School Walkouts, we want to know if you're hitting the street, if your kids are walking out, what you're seeing in your community, and what you think of this whole thing. 816-235-2888. Talk to us about kids walking out of school to demand action on mass shootings. 816-235-2888. Let's start by talking with Mira Levinson, an expert on youth activism, with us from Harvard. Hi, Mira. Welcome to KCUR's Central Standard.
Thank you so much, Gina. I'm really pleased to be here.
Does this look like the beginning of a movement to you?
Well, I would say that it's a continuation of a movement, but probably and ideally an expansion of a movement, because in some ways I think that the contemporary youth-led civil rights movement, especially against gun violence and in favor of youth safety, began with the Black Lives Matter movement, and before that the marches around Trayvon Martin's death, Michael Brown's death, et cetera. So I think it's been going on for now a few years, especially in urban areas and areas in which you have a lot of people of color, and now it's expanding.
Yeah. Can you explain to me how you do see that as a continuation rather than just maybe a parallel thing?
Yeah, because both are really about the risks that young people take leading their lives, and also, in many ways, going to school. There have been youth activists in Chicago for years who have been pointing out the risks that they take, say, when their schools are closed down and they end up being rerouted to schools where they have to cross over gang lines. There's been a lot of activism, actually, around school safety and youth safety in school, before school, after school. And I think that, you know, as we've seen, say, Emma Gonzalez has been the most vocal about this on Twitter, at least, is that she herself sees this movement that she and the other students at Marjory Stoneman Douglas have been igniting as being connected to those movements.
But do you see any new trends emerging in the last month or so?
I think the new trend is that it's become a much more widespread movement that's crossing racial lines, that's crossing class lines, is getting much, much more media attention. And those things are essential in order to bring about long-term change. So yes, I think that this is a really exciting time. I just think that it's a sort of an expansion and an invigoration of a movement that had up until now been treated, frankly, as fairly marginal.
What is your sense of whether schools should be supporting this, maybe even taking a leadership role in making sure kids can participate if they want to?
So schools should be taking a leadership role in students' civic education. That is essential. That's why public schools were founded in this country. It's why we have publicly funded them now for well over 100 years. And it's essential that students develop their knowledge and skills and dispositions as civic actors. That doesn't mean that schools should be taking a position specifically on this movement as opposed to others, although certainly a school saying we want our students to be safe in school makes sense. But that doesn't mean that they should be taking a position specifically on, say, the gun control issues that are right now at the heart of the Never Again and Grades Not Guns movement.
So, but I guess my real question here is, like, activism usually involves breaking a few rules. That's why they call it civil disobedience. And it's sort of a conundrum, right? I mean, if you want to encourage kids to engage civically through activism, but don't they have to also deal with the consequences as part of learning what, say, a walkout is all about?
So some forms of activism do involve breaking rules, such as potentially a walkout, right? But many, many forms of activism don't necessarily involve breaking rules. And those kinds of things, I think schools could do much, much more to support. For example, having students engage in citizenship projects every year. That's part of actually the national frameworks from the National Council of the Social Studies that's suggested for social studies classes nationwide. It's in many state standards. And it is clearly a set of skills and dispositions that students should develop the same way they develop the skills as mathematicians, as readers, as scientists, as baseball players. And there, schools could enable students to research issues that they care about, contact legislators, organize demonstrations. There are all sorts of things that young people can do that don't involve breaking the rules. But you're right, some kinds of actions do involve breaking the rules. And at that point, the school just has to decide sort of how much of a cost they want students to pay.
Well, I want to get back to this conversation with you, but let's talk to a caller. We have Tom in Kansas City calling us at 816-235-2888. Let's talk to Tom.
Hello.
Hey.
I called in because I question the validity of allowing the news media to cover school experimentation in civics class to a national public issue. We teach civil disobedience in our schools. We teach the legislative process, but it is a learning process for those students. They are not active political activists involved in making political decisions for our country.
Okay,
Tom,
you know what?
Age in order to vote.
Oh, I was just going to go ahead and that's an interesting question, and I'd love to hear from our guest on that.
Yeah, that's a great question, Tom. I would say that actually part of the learning process is having students practice being citizens. That is what we do in every other class, right? We don't just teach kids about how other people have done math, but we teach them to do math themselves. We don't just teach kids about how other people have written books or essays or poems. We have them write, you know, essays and stories and poems themselves. We have them play baseball. Everything that we want kids to learn, we have them practice doing it because, in fact, that's the only way to learn it. And that's what we should be doing with civics and citizenship, too. There's no way actually to learn to be a citizen unless you practice citizenship in the same way that you have to practice math or reading or baseball.
All right, we are going to turn now. We've got KCUR's education reporter Ellie Moxley at Oak Park High School. Students there have, I think, started walking out, and we're going to turn to her now. Hi, Ellie.
Hey, Gina, how are you today?
Good. How about you?
Good. Hey, so I'm over at Oak Park High School, one of the North Kansas City schools. All the students here, they've come out of school. There's hundreds of them here. They've formed a circle. And I'm actually standing here with sophomore Malia Biswell, who I think you guys heard from earlier in the program.
Yeah. And so, well, I want to talk to Malia in just a second, but just tell me about the mood there and if anything has surprised you, what the scene is like.
You know, so this has been student-led. The kids started coming out of the building around 10 o'clock. They're all out there now. And, you know, they're really, I think you can hear them in the background. They're chanting, they're cheering. They are, Malia just turned to me and said, this makes me so happy to see her friends, her classmates, her peers organizing to show solidarity with the students in Parkland that went through this horrific thing at their school.
Well, can we go ahead and talk to Malia now?
We can. I'm going to pass the phone off to her, Gina. Here you go.
Hi, Malia.
Hi.
So what inspired you to walk out today?
I was inspired by the students in Florida who have been the victims of this terrible tragedy. They created a movement, and they have started something that's really important. I was inspired by the fact that I am only 16, so I cannot vote legally, and this is my chance to share my voice as a minor who doesn't have one yet. This is a chance for me to be able to be a part of a movement, be a part of unifying all of us kids who don't want to be shot in our schools.
What have your parents said about you walking out of school today? Have you guys talked about it?
My parents are supportive. Yes, my parents are supportive. My mom is, she feels the same way as me. She doesn't want me to be in danger whenever I go to school. She doesn't want any kids to be in danger whenever we go to school. And that's what's happening. So my mom is very supportive in this.
What about the school itself? I mean, are you going to face consequences for walking out today?
No, our administration has given us a place to walk out. They have organized all of us to be like speaking and holding hands in a circle. All of this, the administration they were all for it. They weren't really a fan of the fact that we were going outside of the building because that scared them a little bit. But no, they're not giving us truancies or absences or anything like that. They are supportive of us.
What is the message in that to you? I mean, what does that mean to you?
I think it means that, you know, administration, people in the schools don't want us getting shot either. They care about us too. And it's like a really big thing, and it's a change. They're having a moment of silence right now as well.
I'm sorry to be making you talk during the moment of silence.
I apologize, and it's okay. I think it just really means that they're on board with us, and they want to keep us safe as well.
You know, you talked about that. What inspired you is partly just not wanting to get shot at school. And I'm curious about how heavily that concern weighs on you in your day-to-day life as a high school student here in the KC metro area.
It does scare me. It really does worry me every day that there are more and more kids dying, that the rate of injuries and the rate of deaths grows every single day. And it's because of shootings that happen at school. School is where we're supposed to be the best place for us to be. Kids are starting to walk back inside now. We're chanting.
What are they chanting?
They're chanting, "We are the change," as they were walking inside. And they're all walking inside now. And we're supposed to just go back silently to our classes.
Well,
Malia,
I know you've been really involved in all of the work leading up to this. So I want you to be able to get back and be a part of it. But thank you so much. And say, could you pass the phone back to Ellie?
Yes.
Thank you so much. Ellie.
Yes.
Has anything surprised you today? Just being there and what you've actually seen?
You know, one of the things that I thought was really interesting is all of the kids came out, you know, their classmates really wanted to make sure that they were there for the right reasons. You had young people telling, you know, their peers, like, hey, stop fidgeting, quiet down, be respectful. This is a moment. Like, we need the adults to take us seriously. And to do that, we need to, you know, we need to conduct ourselves like, you know, we're ready to participate in our citizenship, in our country, and that's what it's going to take. So I thought that was an astonishing amount of, you know, kind of self-awareness from these young people. I mean, teenagers are great. I get to spend a lot of time in high schools that a lot of people don't get, and they always constantly surprise me with how clever and sincere they are.
Well, Ellie, thank you so much. I'll let you get back to your reporting there. But Ellie Moxley is KCUR's education reporter, and she's talking to us from Oak Park High School. Thanks, Ellie.
Thank you.
Mira Levinson, talk to me about what you just heard.
I think that what we heard was a terrific example of one young person representing literally many millions of young people across the country who really do want to be taken seriously, who what we heard is somebody who's not only afraid for herself, right, and is doing this for herself and her school, but also feels a sense of solidarity across the country with others who are experiencing the fear or who have actually experienced the trauma of a school massacre. And their idea that they are the change and that through collective action they can make a difference is right. And so I found it really exciting and inspiring to listen to her speak.
You know, we're hearing about a high school walkout, but when we talk about youth activism today, it sounds like youth can mean a lot of things. We're hearing just anecdotally about parents at elementary schools talking to principals about the possibility of walkouts. I mean, that would include like kindergartners.
Yes, here in Boston, what I've been seeing is in many cases, say principals or principals in consultation with parents have set different rules for different grade levels. So say fifth graders on up have very frequently been sort of permitted to walk out or encouraged. In some cases, say second through fourth graders are observers, but not actually participating in the walkout. And then my sense is that most kindergartners and first graders, if they're participating at all, it's through a conversation in class about ways to support one another, to keep each other safe, to stand up for each other, because there are developmental concerns and you don't want kids to be scared. And at the same time, we don't want to use the excuse of, say, scaring kids not to discuss these issues, because kids are paying a lot of attention and they know and are hearing a lot that we may not be aware of. And so we don't want to just stay silent and pretend that they don't know anything, because that can actually make it worse.
What about kids who don't want anything to do with this? I mean, how does the school support those kids and at the same time support the, you know, burgeoning civic activism of others?
Right. So there are two things. Some kids may not want anything to do with this because they just don't feel civically engaged. They think it's stupid. They think it may not make a difference. They just don't care. And there, the school just needs to make sure that they have, you know, a space to be in which they can be learning or engaged and not engaging this. Other students may not want to participate because they're actively opposed to the substantive issues at play, right? They may be in favor of expanding access to guns, expanding gun rights, et cetera. And the school needs to make sure to be providing the same level of support to those students as they are providing to the students who are, say, walking out in favor of gun control and school safety. And they can do that again by allowing students to stay in the classroom and whether it's researching the issue, writing about it, creating a video that they want to post on their own, YouTube channel, or if they have Insta, you know, whatever. So there are ways in which schools can support students at all stages of civic engagement and involvement and on all sides of a substantive issue.
I wonder if there's a difference in how we view this sort of thing in the United States, youth activism and students taking to the streets to protest around education issues and safety issues, and how it's seen in other countries. I mean, is there a longstanding tradition of kids being engaged in a different way outside the U.S.?
So there have been amazing examples of youth activism all around the world in recent years and decades. Probably Malala may be the most internationally well-known youth activist specifically around girls' access to education, right? And she's won the Nobel Peace Prize for it. But Tiananmen Square, right, in China now 25 years ago or more, I guess, those were teenagers and, kids in their 20s who were protesting in favor of freedom and democracy. The Umbrella Revolution in Hong Kong was led by youth activists. Many of the demonstrations in Tahrir Square and around the Arab Spring were also led by teenagers and young adults. We have examples of youth activism actually around the world where young people are trying to make a difference in their societies around issues of democracy and openness and liberation, and also specifically around issues of education. There have been amazing demonstrations in Mexico surrounding the disappearance of 46 teachers and students learning to become teachers that have been going on for some years now as well.
You know, I'm also curious about parallels between this movement and the sit-ins and marches of the civil rights movement, because, you know, we heard from that student earlier in the show who really sees that as inspiration and really seems to be saying this could be our generation's chance to do something like that.
Yes, I think she's right to see those parallels. I'll put a plug in, actually. A couple of friends and I and a bunch of volunteers created an online learning resource called youthinfront.org that helps students make those connections and learn some techniques for organizing and activism, including some from the civil rights movement. I think that the most obvious example about this was the Birmingham Children's March, which is movement. Adults were being jailed too frequently, losing their jobs, etc. They were not able to sustain the movement. And so youth stepped up in Birmingham, Alabama, and said, we'll do it. And in fact, there were kids as young as 8 and 9 years old who walked out of school, who were jailed for over a week. Audrey Hendricks was, I think, the youngest marcher we know about, and she marched out of her school and was jailed for a week in order to try to protest for equal rights for African Americans. And you were asking me earlier about the ways in which schools can or should not, you know, support students, that part of civil disobedience is being disobedient. In those cases, oftentimes the teachers would face the front of the room and write on the blackboard so that their backs were to the students, so that they would not see students actually climbing out the windows in order to get to the march. So there are ways in which teachers can support them without being obviously supportive.
You know, I have checked out that youthinfront.org, and one of the things you do have there is older activists, experienced activists giving advice to young people who want to stand up for things, whether it's advice on safety during walkouts, which I saw up there today, or, you know, any number of things. Is there a piece of advice that is on your website that you want to share with students who might be out there walking out right now?
Yeah, I think I'll give two pieces of advice. One is that a single walkout, a single march, obviously is not enough. And so we actually have a bunch of resources on the site about how you turn a march into a movement. And working with others and acting collectively rather than individually and acting systematically is a really important piece of turning a march into a movement. And then the other piece of advice I would give is that to the extent that you still want to protest or make your views known in schools separately from walkouts, which, as you noted, can get you in trouble, wear a t-shirt that does not have any profanity on it, but that expresses your viewpoint about the issue. And there's quite good Supreme Court precedent saying that you have the right to do that.
Before we go, we've just gotten a call from Nick, and I want to go ahead and hear what Nick has to say. Nick.
Yeah, hello. Hey, I thought I would call in and maybe give a point of view from a parent of a student who organized a walkout.
Yeah, how old is your
eighth grader? Yeah, she's in eighth grade. She's 14, and she organized a walkout at a middle school here in Lee Summit.
What inspired it, and what role did you play in it?
You know, I think she was inspired just kind of how we run our household. We're kind of very aware. We're very involved. We have the news on a lot. We have kind of freewheeling discussions about politics and issues that are going on. So she's kind of really in tune that way. And she just kind of took it in her own hands and kind of ran with it. Did most of it on her own. I really didn't help her at all. I gave her a few pointers here and there, but she was the one who made the flyers, contacted local media, kind of made them aware. She went to the school and asked them for permission, you know, just to make sure she wouldn't get in trouble. And they were really great about it.
Do you think she's gotten something out of this experience?
You know, I think so. I think so. I mean, I think she's seeing the results. You know, a lot of kids were doing it, and then she was getting some flack from maybe kids that had different opinions. And she still kind of pushed through and went with it and was really driven. So I'm waiting. I just sent her a text a little while ago to ask how it went, so I'm kind of waiting to hear what she has to say about how the walkout actually went and if it was everything she was expecting. So,
well,
but, you know, I think she's really proud of herself and really motivated.
Interesting stuff. Thank you, Nick.
Yeah, no problem.
And Mira Levinson with us from Harvard University. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Gina. It was a pleasure to be on.
Mira is a professor of education, and she's involved in the Justice in Schools project there. KCUR Central Standard will be right back after this break. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. After spending 23 years in prison for a crime he didn't commit, Lamont McIntyre has a few things he really wants to do.
Own my own home, be established, you know, pay my own bills. Just typical stuff a 40-year-old person would probably experience in his late 20s, early 30s.
In many states, Lamont would get monetary compensation for all the years he lost, but not in Kansas. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today, with a few high-profile cases of wrongful conviction in the state, we're talking about how you do make up for lost years of a person's life when mistakes get made. Let's start by getting the info, and then we'll jump into those ethical questions. Justin Wingerter is a reporter formerly with the Topeka Capital Journal, and he's working on a book about one of the big cases of recent years, the Floyd Bledsoe case. Hi, Justin.
Hey, good morning, Gina.
Hi. Who is Floyd Bledsoe? What's his story?
So Floyd Bledsoe was wrongfully convicted of a murder in Oskaloosa in 1999 that his brother committed. His brother led police to the body, handed over the murder weapon. He confessed multiple times, and seemingly what should have been an open and shut case turned, and investigators and the county attorney and instead decided to prosecute Floyd. He was wrongfully convicted in 2000 and was finally released in 2015, at the end of 2015, due to DNA results, which showed that his brother, as originally believed, did in fact commit the murder of Camille Arfman, 14-year-old girl in Oskaloosa. And Floyd has since been a strong advocate for several measures in Kansas to rectify and try to change Kansas law, including this issue of compensation that we're talking about today.
What was the conversation like around the issue of compensation in 2015?
It's remarkable how much this conversation has changed. In 2015 and into 2016, when Floyd really was at the legislature and pushing for this change, it was an issue that just did not have any traction. Floyd was the only one there, along with maybe a couple advocates, but he was the only exoneree there pushing for this change. And it didn't have any kind of momentum. Part of it was the budget issue, but much larger, it looked like an isolated case. What you have now as you alluded to, and you played the clip from Lamont McIntyre, you have really three high-profile cases in Kansas of these wrongful convictions. And so these three men have, Floyd, Lamont McIntyre, Richard Jones, have really been this trio. They're all coincidentally 41 years old, all of whom spent more than 15 years in prison for crimes they didn't commit. And they have been instrumental, really, in grabbing the attention of legislators and the public and advocating for this change. And I think the other factor is really the national media. I mean, there are a plethora of TV shows, podcasts, and books centering on wrongful convictions right now. I think that's led more and more people to say something must be done when an injustice like this occurs. And more states are really looking to this option.
When you talked about the budget concerns in Kansas being sort of top of list when it came to, like, why not provide remunerations, what else? I mean, what are some of the other arguments against doing that? Are there other arguments?
There was some concern from just a few lawmakers. It was kind of a minority opinion, but there was some concern that this could be used in some fraudulent way, that a defendant could somehow withhold evidence from even his defense attorney, allow himself to be wrongful, or she for that matter, to be wrongfully convicted, and then use this as a way to gain money down the road. It would be an extremely convoluted and unusual way to defraud the state, and would have a lot of pitfalls along the way. There was that opinion, but really there was just a lack of momentum. It wasn't so much opposition a couple years ago as it was just people not being familiar with this topic and not really therefore having any interest in getting behind it. Now, when you have...
Go on.
When you have these three wrongful convictions, these high-profile cases that more and more people are familiar with, again, I think that trio has just been able to push it, and it's been allowed. Legislators have had to take a look and say this is not an isolated case of Floyd Bledsoe in some small town, but this is, you know, there's an urban example and a rural example, and it's more than that, and we have to start taking a look at it.
Is it partly with this trio of guys, you mentioned they're all 41, the part of their lives that they missed? I mean, that is in terms of building a career, starting a family, like that's a very particular time in someone's life, their early adulthood.
Yeah, I mean, certainly legislators could remember the good times they were having in their 20s and 30s, which are the times that these, you know, whether it's having fun in your 20s or you're raising children, you're getting married, buying a house. I mean, those things you heard Lamont McIntyre talk about. I mean, certainly anyone could understand that if you lost those because of someone else's wrongdoing or error from police and prosecutors, then you would certainly, I think anyone could understand that there would be a desire to get something back, some sort of compensation for that.
Is Kansas in the minority on this? I mean, do most states compensate people for that lost time, for that hardship?
They do, and Kansas is in the minority of the 18 states who do not. There are 32 and the federal government and Washington, D.C. as well that do compensate. That differs widely, and the politics of it can be sort of interesting. Texas obviously has this notorious reputation as being hard on crime, hard on defendants. They have the most generous compensation package of $80,000 a year, along with some other annual payments and some other options. They're actually the most generous on that front. And so, and Kansas is looking at $80,000 right now. There is legislation allowing for that. So that's being considered, and that would put Kansas, it would take it from being a state, one of the minority of states without any compensation, to being one of the most generous.
Well, hang on with me. This is, you know, a tough question, figuring out how you could possibly make things right after making a mistake that costs someone years of their life. But if money is the way, that has its own set of ethical conundrums. And I want to turn to David Tamez on this. He's a professor of philosophy at KU. Hi, David.
Hi.
So the ethical questions here are huge.
Right. And I think as the question as it's currently stated, namely the value of a human life, it's a very abstract question. And I think in one sense, most intuitions are that the human life can't be, or its value can't be calculated. It's immeasurable how much a life is worth. But so I think one way to think about it, or at least make the question more tractable for calculating the value, is to say, what's the value of a lived life? And by that I mean what's the value of the sort of life that a typical person would live out for the rest of their lives, and what sort of things or elements make up a lived life? So we're talking about wages earned, a career pursued, goals that we pursue, relationships that we form, and general projects that we want to follow. And so that seems one way of making the question more tractable for legislators to think about when determining what sort of value or what sort of compensation is the just way, or is a just compensation or a fair compensation for someone who's lost years on their life for being wrongfully convicted.
It's interesting because, like in the workplace, for example, time is equated with money very directly. You work, you know, per hour or for a salary per month or whatever it is. But usually there is some relationship between time and money. But when you think about that, it's not just time in terms of labor, but it's also just time in terms of a stage of your life and what you are doing instead of all those other things you could have been doing. I mean, who knows what people did experience in prison that might have been negative, might have been positive. It's a lot to ask. And I'm wondering if there is a non-monetary way of measuring all of that or of imagining what justice would look like here.
Right. And I think so in a vague or an abstract sense, justice is what we think is the reasonable thing to do in a given situation. And for those people who have been wrongfully convicted, right, we're not just thinking about the lost wages or the sort of monetary harm that they've accrued over those years. But in a sense, the sort of injustice that's been done to them, the sort of lack of fairness that's been placed upon them. So we're trying to consider what not only what sort of tangible harms have been done, but also what would justice look like if we were to calculate in order to do right by the person, because we're not just trying to give them the sort of wages that they've lost, but also make up for or allow them the possibility to regain those abilities, regain those opportunities to the point where they don't have to toil over or restart their life over in trying to earn the wages that they've lost, and so that they could pursue the social relationships, the sort of social goals that would typically have had they not been incarcerated.
So for you, is it ethically problematic to assign a dollar amount to lost years? I mean, it's not lost years in the sense that these are people who remained alive and they do still have the rest of their lives to live, but these are years where they had no agency.
Right. I think it's it may not be it might be problematic in the sense that no value or no sort of monetary value that we come up with is going to do justice, or is going to maybe be acceptable on the part of the person that we've wrongfully convicted. So in that sense, it's you might say monetary or the monetary value or the sort of the money that we compensate them is maybe not be enough. So maybe we allow other sorts of I think other states allow other sort of services, like they give them health care, they give them education benefits. And those are sort of things that we can give them to start their life over again. And so you might say that money alone would not be the ethical thing to do or the fully ethical thing to do.
Well, we are going to keep going with this conversation. We've been hearing from a philosophy professor on how you would compensate someone for the years they lost while wrongfully imprisoned. The state of Kansas doesn't do that, but some people say they should. After the break, we are going to bring in an actuary from the insurance business. How do you put a dollar amount on years of someone's life? I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. And now we're going to keep talking about this issue of Kansas being in the minority of states and not providing remunerations to people who have spent time in prison for crimes they didn't commit. We've heard from reporter Justin Wingeter, philosophy graduate student David Tamez, and now we've got an actuary with us, because how do you put a dollar value on years of someone's life? Kevin Krebs, good morning.
Good morning.
You kind of do that in your line of work.
I do kind of do that in my line of work.
Does it seem weird to you to assign a numerical dollar value to, like, X number of years of someone's life?
It does seem weird. It's hard to imagine a dollar amount compensating for the time spent that you didn't really live. You didn't have that opportunity. I think Justin alluded to that, where, you know, you're not a person. You've lost more than just years.
What are some of the factors that come to mind that would have to be considered when evaluating the worth of a particular individual's time if they were behind bars?
Well, there's an easy go-to with the amount of money you would have earned. You know, you've earned a salary, you've earned a wage. But also, I mean, you think back 10 years ago, I think back to myself where I was 10 years ago and all the experience that I've gained. There's a loss of that experience, and there's a loss of the relationships you have. I saw on LinkedIn email that 80% of people get jobs from people they know. Well, now if everyone you've known for the last 10, 15 years are inmates, I mean, they're not going to help you get a job. So there's trying to quantify that is difficult or nearly impossible. But, you know, you'd sort of look at, okay, where were people, you know, the 15 years, let's take the 26-year-olds who weren't imprisoned, and let's look at them when they're 41 years old, and, you know, where the Lamont and Floyd were getting out of prison. What did they lose? Well, let's look at the 26-year-olds who are now 41, and what have they gained over those last 15 years, and try to quantify, you know, wages, relationships, you know, healthcare.
Yeah, because one of the tricky things is that you can't know what would have happened if that person had not been behind bars. You can't say, I will give you what you would have had, because there's not this picture of that other universe.
Yeah, and that's a good point, because what we'd be doing is basically doing an average. How did the average 26-year-old, you know, age to a 41-year-old? And you can't do that, because you can only do an average, really, as an actuary. You can't really do what was Lamont's life. Would have he been in 41, or Floyd's life at 41? Because maybe he would have ran into somebody who gave him an opportunity, and they are a millionaire all of a sudden.
So that's interesting to me, though. In the insurance business, you work on averages, whereas in a case like this, it sounds like there's a part of you that would feel a little more compelled to evaluate the particular person and their story.
Yeah, that's a good point, and it's kind of hard to do unless you start digging into that person, that story. And, you know, we have budget concerns that we're worried about. And so are we going to commit, you know, tons of people to figure out this person and where they would have been? And it'd be wrong almost every time, because we don't know. It's impossible to know what would have happened.
But in the insurance business, do you dig into stories, or do you deal strictly with numbers when you're figuring out, like, a life insurance policy?
For me personally, I try to keep the thought of the person out of it. It's easier to, you know, think about paying a death claim when it's a number. You know, it's, you know, we've all had losses in our life. You don't want to be thinking about that every time you have a question about a death claim or life insurance or health insurance. You almost want to keep the person out of it.
So the other question there, though, is that when you're dealing with life insurance, you're talking about years that are always going to come off of the end of someone's life. And in this case, we're talking about years that are often, you know, in the middle of someone's life, where they still have life to live afterwards.
Right. And an important part of their life. I mean, 26 to 41, you know, in the case of the three examples, I mean, you're setting yourself up for the rest of your life. And you think about the fact that even like a 401k, you know, the money you put in your 20s is now 5-6 times when you retire. And so it's a middle of your life. It's an important part of your life, and it's an important part for your future life. And that would need to be taken into account if possible.
As an actuary, do you think about ethics and,
yes,
like the meaning of life?
Maybe not in that way. I think about ethics more in a professional sort of, you know, I have taken a lot of professionalism courses. It's strongly encouraged by, you know, the Academy of Actuaries to be professional and to think about it. But it's more perform your work ethically versus thinking of lives ethically.
Interesting. You know, David Tamez, jump back in here, because yeah, as I've just alluded to, one of the tricky things is that no one knows what might have happened. From a philosophical standpoint, how do you wrestle with that?
No, and I think so appealing to an average sort of life or an idealized life is sort of the only way to make the question tractable. If you're in the business of compensating, if you're in the business of coming up with a number, but I think there is some appeal to listening to stories, listening to individual. Individual lives, because you not only want to do, because when you're thinking about doing the right thing by them, you're talking about the actual person, that individual person. And so at least thinking of ethics in that way, doing what's doing right by them. And if you think about it too much in an idealized way, you might miss the mark, at least with that individual person.
Where does the question of accountability fit into the ethics around all of this? Because one thing Lamont McIntyre has said is that he wants states to compensate people for lost years because he says that without that sort of financial incentive to get it right, that there is no incentive to have justice done, to make sure that there aren't wrongful convictions.
Right. I think there's some concerns with that because it's not a guarantee that this will act as an incentive for prosecutors to do extra, because I think by way of ensuring that they have the right person, that they're convicting the right person, because it, in a sense, they already have that motivation, and in another sense, some prosecutors may not be in that same position by the time someone's proven innocent over time, so that might not play in on their decision making process, at least to the point that we think it might. In terms of accountability, so that's a difficult question, or who's responsible? So, if the state or the prosecutor followed the procedure to the T without any sort of gross negligence, it's hard to say that it's hard to say that they're responsible, given that they did everything that they could in the right way and in the ethical way to bring out this conviction. They didn't do wrong by the procedure. And so it's hard to say that they are responsible in an ethical way, but it seems the just thing to do or the right thing to do to have some sort of compensation there.
Are there other ethical questions that the whole idea of compensating people for time lost due to wrongful conviction? I mean, does that raise other ethical and philosophical questions for you as someone who studies philosophy?
Right. I mean, the primary issue is is there a price? Is there a number that someone can be satisfied with? And I don't think that necessarily one is what we should aim for, because I don't think there's ever going to be that sort of number. And two, I think doing something is better than not doing anything at all. So when we're trying to say, we can ask all the questions whether it's ethical or not, or who should,
what the number would be,
or what the number would be or should be. But at the end of the day, if we think that justice is, or what the reasonable thing to do in this part is to compensate them, then we have to go from there. We have to start with a few assumptions. That there is a right way, and then we have to come up with a procedure of determining that right number, that right way.
Justin Wingeter is a reporter who's followed one of these cases. When people talk about the fact that Kansas doesn't provide remunerations, are these the kinds of things that come up?
Yes, and I would point out that there are people every single day who come up with a figure, a dollar amount, for wrongful convictions, and their juries. It's actually cheaper and more efficient for taxpayers if the state pays rather than civil lawsuits, which is traditionally the way of getting compensation.
Wait, explain that.
Well, two examples. I mean, you have in Kansas, Eddie Lowry was wrongfully convicted of rape in the town of Ogden, and he later was given $7.5 million in a lawsuit. In Missouri, you had Ryan Ferguson, who was wrongfully convicted of murder and awarded $11 million for serving a decade in prison. That is actually, those amounts, which are, again, are paid by tax dollars, are much higher than you will ever get and even if you have an $80,000 per year compensation bill in Kansas, even if that bill is signed into law, you're not going to reach those levels of compensation. So if those men had been paid by the state, even a state with a generous compensation package, taxpayers would have paid out much less, and the issue would not have dragged out in courtrooms. This would actually codify it and put it in a way that is more concrete. It is more efficient. You would have a system in place where, you know, you just show you served this time in prison and you'd receive this amount of money. And so that would actually be a little more efficient and cheaper for taxpayers.
What does Floyd say about all of this?
Floyd has his own lawsuit pending in federal court, and so he will largely not be affected, but he is an advocate for compensation.
Well, our time is up, but Justin Wingeter, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And David Tomez with us from KU. This has been really interesting. Thanks.
Thank you.
And Kevin Krebs, thank you.
Thank you.
Kevin is Vice President of Actuarial at United Life Insurance Company. You can listen back to this morning's discussions at kcur.org/centralstandard. We'll have them ready for you later today. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, how people in the Flint Hills and throughout Kansas take weather into their own hands in their day-to-day decisions, and a new book by a Kansas travel writer. That's tomorrow at 10. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan, with help from intern Matt Groby. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Up to Date is next, so stick around for that.